This week's show with Cindy Jackson is sponsored by Stitchville USA and Avlia Mediterranean Folk Embroidery. Krista West at Avlia Mediterranean Folk Embroidery is an absolute machine when it comes to generating new designs, and this month she has released two designs. The first is Naxos Lattice, which is a lovely all-over design inspired by the distinctive repeating patterns found in embroidery from the island of Naxos. It's great if you're looking for a meditative stitching project or want a long, narrow runner, or both. Pasha Basket 2022 is her second release, and it is releasing in December, so you have plenty of time to stitch it before next year. It's an intricate, central, stylized cross outlined with a lovely border featuring checkerboard detailing and two cross motifs. Pasha Basket is designed to be worked in one color and will work beautifully as a food basket cover. See all of Krista West's designs at avliaembroidery.com. And when you're ready to kit up an Avlia design or any other design, the place to go is our second sponsor, Stitchville USA. Stitchville USA is located in Minnetonka, Minnesota, a short drive from Minneapolis, and specializes in cross-stitch, needlepoint, hardanger, punch needle, wool applique, counted canvas, framing, and finishing. The destination shop has more than 4,200 square feet with a large selection of patterns, fabric, fibers, canvas, and notions. And I speak from experience when I tell you it's well worth planning a trip to visit the shop. And if you order online, I can confidently tell you, you will experience rapid, prompt shipping. For more information, visit their website at stitchville.com. Thanks to our sponsors, Avlia Mediterranean Folk Embroidery and Stitchville USA. And now on to our conversation with Cynthia Jackson. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our guest this week, our artist this week, and oh boy, what an artist, Cynthia Jackson, Gutter Lane Embroidery. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. It's nice to be here. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
All right. Now, we were talking before we started recording about mudlarking. I have a sense it has nothing to do with embroidery, but now I got to know. So, what is mudlarking?
Well, London has been on the banks of the Thames for like a millennium, and lots of civilizations have grown up around London. And every time the tide goes out and comes back, because it's quite a deep tide there. I know nothing about tides and tide times and things, but there's a lot of things that get washed up on the shore from all those different civilizations. And you never know what's going to pop up. So lots of people have licenses. You have to have a license to mudlark. And I just went down for an hour with a friend who was a mudlarker. And we just picked up some very common items, such as pins, lots of Tudor pins, or, you know, medieval up to 17th century kind of, and pipe stems, and pieces of porcelain and things like that. Just they're everywhere.
Really? But it's that like you don't have to go digging and spend hours with a shovel or anything.
No, not at all. Nope.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought it was more like Where's Waldo, or, you know, like the hide and seek sort of pictures. Like, you know, is it, so were they difficult to see? They weren't difficult to see then.
No, they're right in with all the little pebbles and everything else that washes up on the shore. It's just like a little rubble, just like small pebbles and rubble. And but it's quite dangerous because the tide is there's a big undertow, of course, the river there, and the tide does come up quickly. And there's not a lot of space either. So it's a very dangerous kind of thing to do.
So that's why then you have to be licensed or be with someone who's licensed so that they've at least had some training and you don't get hauled into the water.
Exactly. Because it is very dangerous and wet and slippery and all those things.
And I'm sure doing right. that kind of searching, your mind gets locked into that and you forget about the nature around you. Yeah.
That's right. Your eyes are just focused right on your feet kind of thing. And you're not really seeing anything. You're just seeing pebbles and bits of pieces. And it's just really interesting.
Wow. So, all right. So you found stuff. Do you have to leave it? Can you take it? Can the licensed person keep it?
Well, I think I'm not too sure about all the regulations, but I'm pretty sure that you have to, if you find anything unusual or that's perceived to be valuable, you must report it. And I think there's some kind of a interchange with the museums, depending on what you find.
Oh.
You report it to the museum and then they will do research on it and things like that. But pins, for instance, which is what I really wanted to find, was just a couple of Tudor pins, because they were so common in Tudor dress that I just wanted to find a couple Tudor pins. And I found a couple.
Oh.
That's fabulous.
And they're very fine. They're very fine pins. You know, they're much finer than you would expect.
Now, these are pins that, not decorative, but pins they use to hold clothes together?
Yep. Just like our pins now that we use to, you know, put into fabric to make patterns and things.
Yeah.
So are they longer or shorter than what we use now?
They come in all different sizes.
Really?
Depending on, time and what they were used for.
Oh, interesting.
Now, I'm not an authority on these things. I was there for an hour. But there are lots of sites on the website with real mudlarkers and very interesting finds that they've found. Interesting things they've found.
There's a lady I follow on Instagram, and I think she's called London Mudlarking, and she just put out a book. And I mean, it just fascinates me what she has found while she's been out. And I think it's that history part of us that, you know, that people who do embroidery who are interested in history, it's like, wait, this is kind of like a little look back into time when you do
it
that.
It is. And it's just one of the little avenues or rabbit holes that you can go down in when you do history stuff, because it's, you know, Tudor pins, they're only Tudor pins, but it's a fascinating activity. And it's just a way into the history as well.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes.
What fun. Beth, you should go mudlarking at the Mississippi there, see what you dig up. I'm going to guess there's nothing.
Well, actually there's buttons. You can find buttons that people used to make, because we live in an area that they had lots of button factories around here.
Oh.
So people find, the buttons that they rejected in the Mississippi.
Excellent.
There's all kinds of things you can find in rivers. I was doing an exhibition up at our local textile museum. And in their textile museum, they had all kinds of things that they found, bottles and buttons and all kinds of things that they found in the river, because there was a textile mill there. So it just becomes a repository of things that aren't used anymore.
I was going to say, and not too long ago, if you didn't want it, you threw it in the river. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah. Okay. All right. So this now gets to the first question I had after all the research on you. Which is it that gets your heart beating faster? Is it needlework research, or is it design and stitching?
It depends on which day it is, what time of the year, and what I'm doing at the moment.
Okay.
At the moment, it's the history and the research.
Okay.
But there's always stitching involved in that. Not so much design, but research and stitching, experimental.
Yeah. Now, is this the research thing? I mean, it doesn't take long to discover that you've done an awful lot of it, and you've studied thoroughly needlework from one end to the other. Is it something that is history something that's always interested you, or did this just come out of needlework and then you wanted to know what the history was behind it?
Yes, That's it was the needlework came first, and the history followed about 20 years later.
Okay.
And it followed because I was asked, I had not done a whole lot of embroidery for a long time, because when I came back to Canada from school, there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for me to do embroidery or to earn a living at that. So I was retrained. And then all those years that I was doing something else, I didn't do a whole lot of embroidery. I did my own, you know, interest things.
Yeah.
But nothing professional. And then I was asked when I moved to Ottawa to speak at the cathedral here about needlework for the church and symbolism in the needlework and that kind of thing, and to teach a short class in embroidery stitches. So that started me doing the research on the history of the Opus Anglicanum and all those kind of things. And that was 30 years ago. So I've been kind of involved in that ever since.
Okay. Now, are you born in Canada and then lived in England, or born in England and then moved to Canada?
Born in Canada, moved to England to go to school, and then came back.
Okay. And what makes you go to England then to go to school?
I finished high school, and I wasn't very academic. I wasn't looking forward to going to university at all. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was 16 and I had finished high school and just didn't know what to do, but I love to sit and stitch. I love to sit and knit. I love to sit and draw. So, I think my aunt found a cutting, an article in the paper in Ottawa about the Royal School of Needleworks 100th anniversary. So she thought, well, maybe you can do that. I don't know what made her think that I would want to go from Toronto to London. But as soon as I saw the clipping, I thought, wow, it's perfect for me. It would be just like I would be in heaven. And so I decided I would find the address and of the Royal School of Needlework and write them a letter. This is pre-email stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had to write a letter and wait until they replied.
How old-fashioned.
And, you know, yeah. So it took like, I guess, about 6 or 7 months to get a couple of letters back and forth. And I applied finally, and they said, no, we don't have any room. So I had to wait for the next year, but that was okay. I was sufficiently interested that I was going to definitely do this.
So you get into this whole thing, just a random mention from your aunt then. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. See how things happen sometimes.
Yeah. But you'd done needlework on an ongoing basis before that. What got you started doing that? Just
my grandmother was always when we visit, she would always be knitting, stitching, quilting, all those things.
Okay.
And we weren't allowed to do anything like sit around and just watch TV, because actually in Ottawa at that time there wasn't much on television. And because we were visiting, we didn't have any friends around. And my sister was a real book reader. And I just hung around with my grandmother, and she taught me how to do all those things.
Yeah.
So that's how I learned.
Okay, basically. Well, but that's, you know, so many people learn because it's the environment. And and you pick up on it and you connect with it. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
And plus, it's a neat thing. It's a family thing that you stay connected to the history of your family. Yeah,
that's right. I've used my grandmother as inspiration and my aunt for a lot of different pieces that I've done.
Yeah. So the Royal School the next year takes you in?
Yes. Yes.
And is this the full diploma program?
Oh, at that time they didn't have that kind of thing. It was strictly an apprenticeship. And in the early 70s, which is when that was, there was it had been a 3-year apprenticeship, and they were struggling. I think this is my interpretation. They were struggling with getting people to come and become apprentices for embroidery in the 70s. And they usually had six. At one time, they had six apprentices, I think, a year. And at this time, there was only 2-year apprentices. Like, it was apprenticeship of 2 years. And there were only 3 in each year.
Mm.
So, and it ended up in my year, there was only 2 in the end, because one of them dropped out.
Yeah, so, that I often wonder about that, because that's pretty intense study. You got to really hang in there.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I was in my year, there were 3 of us, and there was me, the Canadian, and then there was the Australian, and then there was the one from Liverpool. So I think they were expanding their horizons to find people to come and do the apprenticeship.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that like as a teenager to just go across the ocean and start a rather intense study? I mean, did they provide a room and board, or was that on your family to do? Or, I mean, that has to be culture shock and everything.
It was. I was very fortunate to have my sister come with me.
Oh, okay.
She's 2 years older than I am. It wasn't her idea to come. It was my parents. she was doing art history and had almost completed her her BA, and decided that it would be okay to take a year out and see the art in Europe.
Oh.
So she was quite willing to come. And so we went together, and it was a good thing, because I don't know what I would have done without her, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
That whole time. Yeah. Right. Well, she was there for a year, and then I was on my own for a year as well. But then by then, I had kind of made friends and kind of had a good place.
Right. But that's nice that your sister could go with you. I know that, you know, to step out like that when you're 17, you know.
Oh,
I have a sister that's just a year younger than I am, and we did a lot of things together at that age, where, you know, you wouldn't want to go by yourself, but it would be okay. I'm hanging out with my sister. It's okay.
Yes. And we had fun.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. What a great time. So this, the thing about the Royal School studies is, it's always been my impression that it really weeds out the dedicated needleworkers, because the intensity of the work day after day, if you don't really love it, you'll burn out rather quickly. And obviously you connected with it then.
I did. I loved it. We worked from, I lived way outside of London, near Croydon, and it took 2 trains and a tube ride and a 20-minute walk to get there. So I was very dedicated. I would get up at 6 o'clock every morning, and then we wouldn't finish. We started at 9 and didn't finish till 5. So most of the time it was dark when I went there. It was dark when I left. So yes, you had to be dedicated, but I was just in heaven. It didn't matter.
So I
learned so many different kinds, of embroidery.
That was what I was going to ask. You know, what was your favorite section of the classes?
Well, my favorite was anything that was super challenging, like gold work, textural, and also both sides alike was a little bit challenging for me as well. It wasn't as creative, but it was challenging to work from the top and not know what you're doing on the bottom.
Mm.
And that was a particular technique that they used for banners and flags and things like that, that uh-huh. were done by hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, does when you go through a program at the Royal School, does that become a lifelong club? Like, you're always connected to that school and the people there, or do people tend to just kind of go their own way?
Now, Gary, remember, I was there. how many years ago? 40 anyway.
Yeah.
And it was very, very, very differently run than it is now.
Oh, okay.
It's an institution now, and very well known around the world. And at the time I was there, it was not a embroidery was not something that people went and did for a living.
Yeah.
Not in Canada. I don't think in the States much. And they were having difficulty, I guess, finding people in England as well.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. So I don't have any connection at all with the Royal School of Needlework now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there to do a little bit of research, not very much.
Yeah. Okay. I just wonder, but yeah, I suppose it, if it was that different then compared to now, cause yeah, now it is one raging operation, globally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was more like, mom and pop stuff when I was there.
Oh, okay.
And it was friendly, and we were very, the apprentices were close. And so we were with the ladies, and because we spent 2 days a week in the workroom as well, we got to know all the older ladies as well and the stories of their lives and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. It was also shortly after, like, you know, wartime had not been that far behind. It was only 25 years basically since the war. So a lot of the ladies could tell us about all the things during the war in the 50s. And yeah, it was really interesting to sit in the workroom and chat. Couldn't chat terribly loud, but if you're sitting across from someone at a frame, then you could have a nice discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I assume that the needlework education there of the utmost, just top flight.
Different than
yeah.
now.
Uh-huh.
Completely different. We had an instructor for our samples, and we took all our samples at the end. And we passed or we didn't pass, basically.
Oh.
There wasn't all this grading and, all the things that they do now. I just astounds me. The amount of competition, not competition, but grading and judging. Mm-hmm. And I can't, that's not me. That's not my kind of embroidery. No.
Got more formal. Yeah. Yeah.
It did. Yes. Extremely. Extremely.
So then your bachelor's in embroidered textiles from Middlesex,
mm-hmm.
That yep. came after that or before it?
Oh, after.
After.
Way
after. Okay.
Way after. Yeah.
Okay.
I started that, I think 2002, 2003.
Oh.
And it was a correspondence course, and it was through the Opus School of Textile Arts, which is no longer, unfortunately.
Mm.
But the Royal School of Needlework, of course, has their own BA now, and they're the only ones now that do the BA in hand embroidery. But I got in there just under the wire before it became very, very, very expensive for foreign people to come or take any English courses.
Oh.
So I was lucky there, too. I guess I'd just been very lucky. In when I choose to do things or when things happen. I don't choose, really, I guess. It chooses me.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Well, that's all right.
It's time. Yeah.
And timing, good timing never hurts. Never hurts.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So what made you decide to go ahead and take the class in embroidered textiles in 2003?
Well, because I'd always, always wanted, well, when I decided from high school to go to the Royal School of Needlework, I wanted to get a degree, and I didn't realize that there wasn't a degree from the Royal School of Needlework, that it was apprentice and all that kind of stuff. So eventually when I found out that they did have, I've always wanted to go to university, but never been very academic, you know, like writing essays and studying and all that kind of stuff. Exams, no. So when I had the opportunity and it was I also had a young child, and so I had responsibilities here, and the opportunity to do it through correspondence was just something I couldn't pass up. And that way I could learn about the history and learn about contemporary art, like now, modern art, embroidery-wise, and just explore all those options as well. Just expanding my horizons all the time, but only within the embroidery world.
No essays, no exams. I'll stitch, I'll show you.
Exactly.
Just let me show you.
And that's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. I guess we did have to do essays and things as well. And actually, they were very interesting. I guess it depends on the subject matter you're looking into.
Yes, there it is, right there.
I've since done a couple of articles as well, writing and
right. Yeah, you seem to be over that hump as long as it's needlework and embroidery. Yes.
Right. But I was going to say, because your blog on Tudor embroidery, it's nicely well written. It's not, you know, nothing shabby there, right?
Well, I just want it to be, especially the blog, for people to just to read it and just to explore or to see through my eyes what I see. I don't want it to be very. It has to be easy to read. I'm not good with really difficult academic papers.
Good.
Obviously, because I have no real academic background.
Good, because it makes it so much more enjoyable to read. So thank you for that.
Yes.
Yes.
More accessible for everybody.
Right. The research you've done, now you have the Janet Arnold Grant from the Society of Antiquaries.
Yeah. Yes.
And a grant from the Textile Society and EGA. And so you obviously have made an impression if people are going to give you money to do research. What makes you lock into the Tudor embroideries and that whole world? Is it just is it the gold work that draws you in?
It was the gold work that really drew me in, absolutely. Because it was my favorite technique when I was at school, and I had used it, gone back to it after starting to teach and creating new pieces for teaching. And then I saw, after doing the history for the Opus Anglicanum, the next logical step is Tudor. But there isn't a whole lot of Tudor information out there, because there isn't a lot of objects from that time that are still existing. So, and that's because of the history of the time. And that in itself makes it very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Just
what was going on in society and politics and religion and all those things in London at the time. And you know how popular Tudor everything is to people. Well,
yeah.
Tudor embroidery, there was a lot of it at the time. And it's in all the documentation, references to it, and it's obviously in portraits of the period. But there's not that much existing still in museums. You have to really look for it. And so that's what I've been trying to do. I forgot what your question was.
That's okay. It fascinates me that you lock into that area, because was the stuff destroyed, hidden? Is it still hidden away? If you just look for it, you find things?
Well, I'm hoping that if I really look for it, I'll find some things that haven't come to light. But yes, they were, a lot of the religious objects, of course, were destroyed or hidden and came out later.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the Reformation, and Henry VIII and his struggle with Rome and all those things. So the embroiderers were made a pretty good living prior to the Reformation with doing ecclesiastical vestments and things like that. There was a lot of it being done, and so when they were lost that part of their their clients or their, you know, their client base. There were no more religious items. They had to find someplace else to put their talents. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of other things that they did. And that's when embroidery for fashion became really popular as well. It was a struggle, I think. And that's what made me really want to learn about how they transferred their skills and techniques and designs and things from mostly ecclesiastical to mostly fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is it about gold work that locks you in? Is it the texture, the just the shininess? What?
The number of different techniques and materials, that the different wires and the different ways you can put it on, the amount of padding you can do, everything. There's everything. It's pretty monochrome, and that draws me as well because I'm not really very good with color. I'm very bad with color.
See, Beth, I knew I liked Cindy. See, yes, there we go. Thank you. I'm hanging with you, Cindy. All right.
Yeah, the theory, color theory just escapes me completely. Actually, a lot of theory escapes me completely, which is why I'm an embroiderer.
But
so it is the texture and the monochrome.
Okay. And the challenge, I assume that's the challenge really.
Yes. In working with all those different threads and trying to do new things and using the texture to convey shape and form and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't know those words either. That's all art stuff. I don't speak art either.
I don't speak art. Okay.
No, you just do it. That's all.
It's I just do it. Yes.
You just do it. You just do it. And yeah. I think you've got a good intuitive design going, design sense. It definitely works. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. All my designs kind of are based on now they're based on Tudor things that I've seen and just aspects of Tudor culture. So that's what I'm kind of focused on my, when I do a project, that's what I focus on.
Yeah. A true artist. I can't explain it. I just do it. Leave me alone.
That's about it. Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't articulate it any better than that.
Now, I loved reading your writings about the Bacton altar cloth and the work on the broderer's crown. I always want to say broderer's clown, and I have no idea why that is. But with Mike Parr, and we talked to him easily a couple of years ago, fascinating person, amazing talent. But what hit me as I'm reading all this is, obviously, you are a highly skilled designer and needleworker. I mean, there's no question about that. When you look at these ancient pieces of needlework, gold work, what is your reaction to the quality and depth and skill that's involved in that compared to what we do today? Is it just awe-inspiring that, you know, you kind of feel like, as skilled as I am, I could never reach that level, or I'd have to work darn hard to do it?
I think it's a combination of things. It's the skill level, of course, is amazing. And depending on the pieces that you're looking at, I mean, it varies, of course, from piece to piece. But the techniques that they used and the development of the techniques at that time and the different shapes and types of wires and the colors, the combinations of the silk and the metal threads and just it just all just it. It just I'm speechless when I look at them.
Okay.
I just have to take pictures so that I can look at them again and again and again and try and figure out exactly how they could have done these things, because a lot of them are very difficult to try and recreate.
Well, that was what I recall. That's like what I recall from Mike Parr talking about how when you guys were working on the broderer's crown, geez, there I go again, broderer's crown, that so many of the stitches were not normal or not known, and you had to decipher. Is that right? Do I have that remembered right?
It's not that they were terribly difficult. It's the combination of them, and the combination of the different kinds of threads. So what we have available now is not exactly what was available then, of course. So in order to try and recreate the 16th century piece, we had to adapt modern threads, and then try and work them in to recreate the same kind of piece, like the same flower or element on the crown. And it's just layering. They're very simple. It's a very simple technique, but it's complicated in its layering, if you see what I mean. So it's just basically couching for the most part, but it's the sequence in which you couch and the threads that you couch, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, I remember Mike saying that you got the impression that with these guild crowns, that each one was trying to outdo the other, that there was this kind of internal competition to reach a new level every time.
Well, I think the guilds were competitive. The guilds were very important in London in the 16th century. They basically built the economy, kind of thing, with the trade, and the things that they produced. Trade with Europe and around the world towards the end, and the guilds were run so that. Oh, it's really difficult to explain, not being a historian, but having learned all about these different they were like oh dear, industrial guilds, where there was the shoemakers, and there was the carpenters, and then there was the cloth makers, and all these different guilds, but they were all separate, but they all worked together. They interacted, because one guild made something that the other guild needed, kind of thing. And there was all that kind of economy going on. And as far as the crowns go, I don't know that they had competition on the actual crowns, because I don't know that the guilds ever saw each other's crowns, because they were used for election events, once or twice, but once or every 2 years, once a year or every 2 years, and only in the guild, within their own guild. But then they were also possibly worn in, because processions and parades and things like that were very important as well, and there were always these kind of parades as well, like the Lord Mayor's show and things. They'd all get dressed up and wear their, I don't know if they wore their crowns or not, but they wore their gowns, the crowns and gowns. So it was show was important. Show, yeah, visual articulation of things that, oh dear.
No, I understand. My first one of my first press trips to Europe, I don't know if it was London or not, but we had a press dinner in a guild hall. And, what's the big deal? Of course, us Americans, what do we know? What's the big deal with a guild hall? And then we got an education about basically they were the backbone of industry in,
Yes, exactly.
and they drove everything. And I really gained a just in that short time gained a real appreciation. So what that when I hear about these old European guilds, I really appreciate the role they played just in developing industry and developing
Exactly.
skills and apprentices and all those things. It's quite an amazing structure.
That's right. And so the embroiderers, or the broderers is what they were called, had their own guild. And of course, it was a very small guild compared to a lot of the other ones, like the tailors, the merchant tailors, and the mercers, and all those quite large guilds. I think there were 40, they were numbered in the early 1500s, and the Mercers are always number one, and they remain number one, and the hierarchy stays the same. And the embroiderers were 48 or 49 on that list in the early 1500s, and they're still 48 or 49 on the list now. And the list keeps growing. So there's about 200 now, guilds now. And the guilds now are very different than they were then, but they're mostly philanthropic, and they raise money for different charities and things. Like, for instance, the broderers raise money for the Royal School of Needlework.
Okay.
The cloth workers donate money to the Royal School of Needlework, and they promote certain things and contests within those schools and institutions. So they're still have a very important role to play even now.
So neat. When you see the broderer's crown or the Bacton altar cloth, when you go to research that thing, or any of them, what is the process? What goes through your mind in terms of, am I studying the stitching, the messages? What are you doing? And then what do you take out of that as you try to emulate it, or use some of the things you learn in your own designs? What happens in your head as you're going through that process?
Very difficult question. What goes through my head? Well, when I go and look at a piece, like, for instance, when I went to see the Bacton altar cloth, I was absolutely floored by what I saw. And it's mostly the same with every single piece that I go to look at. I have to pick myself off the floor because it's just amazing to me, the work that was done in the 16th century with, you know, all the limitations that they had, compared, of course, to what we do now and what we have now. But when you put yourself back into the time, into the context of the 16th century, you can understand it a little bit better. And that's what I get from really studying them up close and trying to reproduce them. You can't make replicas, but you can try and reproduce the actions that they used and the, you know, how they got from the fabric and the materials to the finished piece. And then what was the finished piece for, and maybe how was it commissioned? All those different things are very, very interesting. I have no answers yet.
Yeah.
To any of those questions, but just asking the questions makes you think about what might have been the answer, and when you think about that, then it kind of leads you into other things as well, and it's just fascinating, big puzzle.
I got to believe it's like just about any research. Asking the initial question and then doing the research, in most cases, just raises more questions rather than answers.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah,
and that's kind of exactly how I started formulating my ideas for the grants. Was, you know, they've researched some things and they found some things, but in the publications, there's always a question of, but what more is there? You know, how could you answer that question? And so when I think about what I want to do for a grant, it's more of a, like, how can I really find something out that might tell us something that we didn't know before, or shed some light on some aspect of Tudor culture that that doesn't have to do with royalty? Because there was a lot of people that weren't royal, a lot of nobles that, you know, a lot of people that made the economy work that didn't have, you know, royal blood. Lots of Joe Blows out there just doing their stitching.
Right.
But they were really interesting people as well. And that's, you know, when I started looking into individual embroiderers, I found out that there's a real community of them. And I just wanted to know more. So I kept digging. still no answers, but I have a whole lot of little groups of answers, but nothing that really connects everything yet.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a sense that throughout the castles and abbeys and whatever throughout the UK and Scotland and Ireland and all those places that in back corner closets are still a lot of stuff to be discovered?
I think absolutely. There has to be. I mean, just for instance, the Bacton altar cloth, although it was out in plain sight for like 400 years, basically, it was never studied, mm-hmm. until they brought it to Hampton Court and shed some light on it there. It's still full of questions about the Bacton altar cloth. Just the different elements in it, the botanicals are one thing. And even then, identifying every one of those 60 or 70 different species is really hard, because you're looking at something that was growing 400 years ago.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily exist anymore.
I love that part, and Bess the gardener too. I just love the whole part where you were trying to identify the flowers and compare them to today. And I mean, my degree's in biology. I love wildlife and plant life and animal life and the study. And I'm thinking, oh, you're comparing what grew then to today's hybridized and hopped up plants.
Yep.
And oh, what a challenge.
Yep. And don't forget that was the time of exploration of the New World as well. So where they're bringing plants from other places like North America and South America and trying to introduce them to the gardens, which were very popular in Tudor times, the formal gardens. So just endless questions.
I liked it that they did those, it wasn't just the one plant. They did it in all the phases. So, when it was first coming as a bud and then as it was dying.
On one sprig kind of thing. They included them. Yeah. Because they had to convey a lot of information in one image kind of thing. Yeah. And all those little animals that we looked into, still no answers about that. And then we haven't even started with the, there's a water scene with mythical beasts. And boats and men, and there's also all those bugs, the butterflies and the caterpillars and birds, all kinds of birds. And, where did those ones come from? And when were they done? Were they done at the same time? Were they done later? Were they done before? All those questions. It's just fascinating.
Now, when you do that, take the Bacton altar cloth, is that go there to see it? And obviously study it firsthand, look at the backside, the front side. But the real research comes from hundreds and hundreds of photos you take and take home with you. Is that where the real work comes in, or is it pretty extensive right there in front of the piece?
Oh, no, it's mostly, first of all, I have to explain that it's not just front and you can't, when you go as a researcher to a place like a museum or an institution like Hampton Court, you can't really handle the pieces.
Okay.
You have to, especially with the Bacton altar cloth, I was very fortunate to get there before it was conserved, and actually even before the backing was taken off it, I believe, yes. And I couldn't see the back. It was flat. On a table, and I wasn't allowed to touch it. Mm. Only the curator was allowed to touch it. So she lifted it up a little bit so I could see and take a couple of pictures of the intense color that was on the other side. But I had no idea just how strong all those colors were until I went back afterwards, and they had taken photographs, and she showed me the photographs of the back, and it's absolutely awe-inspiring to see the back of the stitching as well, because you can't always see the back, and so therefore you can't tell exactly sometimes how it was done depending on how complicated the technique. And but seeing the back is a very important part of learning about embroidery. And it's very rare that you can actually do that, because the embroidery is usually always attached to something else.
Yeah.
Or has lining that can't be removed anymore and all that kind of stuff. So you have to really examine, and that's where the photographs come in handy, is take very detailed photographs of what you see on the front. But you can never really follow the threads of these kind of things, because you can only follow them logically.
Yeah. I'm so glad you...
I know how it would be, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But not how exactly they did it.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that about the backs, because, you know, so many people, don't look at my backs, you know, blah, 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 blah. And for me, that's where I learn. I love to look at the back of the stitching. That's where I learn how you executed, how you moved from piece to piece, part to part. To me, that's almost more interesting than the front. Yeah.
That's right. I was so disappointed when I went to see the burst this time when I was in London, and they had fixed it onto a backing without taking photographs of the back.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. And that's fairly recently done. So I'd just like to implore all the curators out there, if anybody's listening, to make sure that before they fix something for exhibition or you know, display purposes, or even just for securing it for survival, that they take images of the back, because it is so important to know how it was done and what was used, because sometimes you can't see on the front all the different elements of the piece, because you can only see on the back what's underneath it.
Right.
What was used. Right. Yeah. So it makes my job a little bit easier.
Right.
Yeah.
And the colors too, when you said, you know, you were surprised at the intensity of the colors.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other part, because we can only guess at the front, and when you see that backside, and I don't think we have an appreciation in general of how intense the thread colors were in those days, because we just see so many faded, worn pieces.
Exactly. And kind of, I don't know about you, but when I was like younger and I thought about, you know, tour times or even past times, anytime, kind of black and white. It's just kind of always in my brain in black and white. It didn't seem to be color. This was like, of course, prior to all the movies and TV shows and things that they've been doing with all the Tudor reenactments and things. But before that, it was really difficult to think of those times as colorful. But now it's we just know that it was as colorful then as it is now.
Right.
When we look at the Tudor design, approach to design and just design elements in general, and then look at your work, the work that you do, that you sell and teach and so on and so forth, I really enjoy it, because there's that classic Tudor look, and then what you do, you can see the influence, but there's it's your own. There's a style to it that is different from just classic Tudor. So you borrow from that and then let your mind go off and do what you want.
Exactly, because part of the creative process is to start with something. Well, my creative process is to start with something, a basic, and then use the materials and the colors and the fabrics and the threads that we have now to reinterpret what they did then, to use their techniques, but to enlarge on them and bring them more up to date, which is, you know, what we want to do nowadays. We want to do our own thing as well as learn about the past.
Right.
And the past kind of informs what we do. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was looking at your Tudor embroidery, the Tudor binding, and that little Bible that was in Greek. Oh. And I thought, Oh, wouldn't that be fun to recreate something small like that? I'm hooked onto caskets. So and I thought, oh, if I
Yep.
made a little book with some stitching
Exactly.
on it and stuck it in my casket, because I've done some bookbinding, and I'm thinking,
Oh,
oh,
yes.
with a little, just a small little motif on the front.
There's a lot of book bindings in Tudor times, books because they were so rare and important articles. They were often embroidered, and they were embroidered either by the owner or by a professional, and they were treasured. And so that's why there are so many of them. And just while I was there, I think I photographed almost 20 in two different places. So,
Oh, really?
yeah, it gives me a good base for a long period of time and the different techniques, because a lot of them are different techniques as well, different materials. And so I can put them in a timeline, kind of. And that's going to be the beginning of my Tudor timeline. So, and I'll fit everything else into that.
Oh,
I guess
fun.
it sounds kind of funny, but that's kind of what I'm doing.
Hey.
Oh,
Why
I
not?
like that. I
I'm
like that.
guessing when you go on a trip to England that the number of photos that you come back with is pretty massive.
Yes, I was very fortunate this time to have someone there, Michelle, who is part of our Bacton Altarcloth group, our little group that we do some research in. She came with me, and she's fabulous with her. She's a techno wizard, and she's also a great photographer. And she took a lot of photographs, like hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of the four places that we went together. We haven't had a chance to get together to sort them out and, have a really good look at them. But when we do, it will be absolutely fascinating. Just the small, fine delicateness of the stitches, and the fact that you have to get, in order to appreciate them and see them, you have to get up close and look at them. It's just, and that little Bible, or the New Testament that you were talking about, Beth, it's so tiny, and there's a whole lot of work on it. There's a whole
Right.
lot of embroidery just on that little, and it's just amazing. There's so many different books and different techniques throughout those 20 books. It's a good base to start with.
I look forward to seeing your images. Are you going to post those on your blog, the Tudor
I
site,
am. I
eventually
am
when
going
you?
to. I am going to post them. Not all of them, but when I do a blog, I'll post specific pictures. You would
Okay.
just be overwhelmed with the number of pictures. And actually, I get quite overwhelmed with them as well. And they have to be sorted, and you have to remember which particular part of this. Some of the objects are like huge, like funeral palls, 9 feet long, and 5 feet wide, and so. When you take photographs and you get up close and detailed with each one, you have to remember where they are as well. So you have to have a kind of a schedule of photographs. So it's photographs become almost, yeah, they take up a lot of space on your computer. They
Yes,
do.
yes, yes, yes. I just thinking when you did that, when you get that timeline of the books up, I think that would be a fascinating look at.
This is all part of the grant for the Janet Arnold Award grant,
Oh.
and all this work is being done with the help of that grant over the next 3 years. Many trips to England, and the grant helps me with getting photographs done if they are not available, and traveling to the different places, like from London to, I want to go to Edinburgh to the Birrell collection on my next visit, because I hope the Birrell collection will be open by then, because it's been closed for quite a long time for refurbishment and rebuilding, I think. So it will help me with my train fares and my accommodations to all these different places. But it, because if I didn't have that help, it would cost, like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it at all.
Right. And so will you publish then? So when you, when you finish in 3 years, you're going to publish like a paper on this?
I will publish. I will publish probably a couple of papers or two or three before I'm finished in various journals. And then I will, and I'm working on a book in the end. So the book will come at the very end, a year or two afterwards.
I hate writing essays. I'm writing a book.
She's writing a book instead.
Oh, did I say that?
I'm just, you know, actually, it's just what I hear. I'm just going by what I hear.
It depends on what I'm the frame of mind I'm in, or the, you know, the space that I'm in, because I can actually sit down and make something, write something that is readable and enjoyable to read, I hope. I mean, I certainly enjoy writing them, and I really enjoy researching them.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that that will be conveyed in the final products, and that people will be interested in learning about them.
I have no doubt, no doubt whatsoever. And for folks, Gutter Lane Embroidery is Cindy's website, but if you want to immerse yourself in her research, TudorEmbroidery.com is the place to go. You can spend hours there, really enjoying what amazing work. Now, of course, now we're running out of time, but I have to learn about your studio, because you wrote it. It really got my mind going. I'm just going to read what you wrote, because it and so you write, "I love my studio. It's quiet, sun filled on sunny days, but still brightly lit when it's cloudy. There's no phone, no fax, no computer, just me, CBC radio, and books on CD. I use stations for various activities. Each has its own physical, emotional, and creative space. Some days I'll be constantly moving from one to the next, and other days I'll settle in one at one and stay there for hours. It's rarely neat, but always organized." Okay, you got to take us through what that space is like when you talk about stations. Is it research and needlework? And
first of all, I have to tell you that was my studio 10 years ago.
Oh, jeez.
And I loved it.
Never mind.
And then it was fabulous. And I didn't have any of those things. I had my radio, I had my CD player, and that was it. No computer. And I accomplished an awful lot. I did two exhibitions, contemporary embroidery for two different exhibitions in that 1 year that I had that studio. And I was, you know, your environment is, a good environment is very conducive to creativity. And that was perfect. Since then, I have had, it's not quite sun-filled anymore because it's in the basement, but and there's no windows. There's two windows, but they have window wells, so the sun doesn't come in at all. But the lighting is fabulous. I do have my computer now. I have a printer. I have a television. I have, oh my goodness, and it is much more difficult to stay on track, I must say. But I still have the stations. I have my different stations. I had a drafting board, and I had a study table, and I had my frame where I worked. And now I have my drafting board, which doesn't get used very much because I use my computer to do, what do you call those drawings? Graphic arts on the computer, mm-hmm. a graphic program. And I have a reading spot where I do a lot of reading for my research. I have my bookcases here, which I didn't have in the other place. And I have my Zoom studio for my classes and a table to work on, and my frame and my big whiteboard. And yes, and it's much bigger, and I get less work done. So, I don't know. Too many distractions. And I'm also in my own home. So in my other studio, I had to go out to. So I went out early in the morning and came back at 5 o'clock at night and worked the whole time. Whereas here, you know, the kitchen is just upstairs. And of course, there's always laundry to do or, you know, television to watch, cleaning to do,
right?
You know, that kind of thing. So it's much harder to stay focused. But I think starting in January, I'm going to make myself a new schedule and I will stick to it. I'm saying now, that's a promise. I think I'm telling a whole lot of people too. Oh dear.
Yeah. You just cut. Yeah. That might've been a mistake right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll check back.
Exactly. we'll check back with you.
Keep me honest.
Yep. Well, I can, you know, that sound, you know, I now have a mental picture of the basement and we talk about the stations. Yeah. Where I can see how you can just go and isolate yourself in your reading area and focus on the research, and the other stuff is not right there. Yes.
Exactly. And then when I need to get up and do some stitching, this my frame is already set up and I just go to there and spend some time at it if I need to, or spend a whole day there, depending on what it is that I'm doing.
That's okay. That's quite all right. Yeah. All right, Cindy, thanks so much, boy. What a treat. Really appreciate the time.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Gary and Beth. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for doing it. Thanks to everybody for listening.